reading from and referring to Master's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita. There is such great truth that he expresses through his commentary, and of course the Gita itself is something that has helped countless generations of souls to realize the truth within themselves. And today the reading is on truth, satya. This comes from chapter 16, and it is verse 1 through 3. Truth, satya, is the foundation stone of the universe. The worlds are built upon truth, says the Mahabharata. Men and civilizations stand or fall according to their attitude toward truth. It's quite a statement. Men and civilizations stand or fall according to their attitude toward truth. An honest person is spontaneously admired by all right-thinking men. The Hindu scriptures, however, point out that a devotee whose ideal is truth should always exercise judgment and common sense before speaking. It is not enough merely to tell the truth. One's words should also be sweet, healing, and beneficial to others. Hurtful statements, however accurate, are usually better left unsaid. And this is an important point when it comes to truth. I have seen people use statements of truth or partial truth almost as weapons. They go after people. They make people uncomfortable. Perhaps they make people laugh or feel embarrassed for themselves or for others. And it's hurtful when that kind of truth is spoken. It hurts the individual that it's being spoken about, and it also hurts the speaker himself. Because, as is truly said, when you point your finger at somebody, there's three fingers pointing back at you. And you always have this. You are always the first listener to the words and the intention through which you speak. When you say words to hurt instead of to heal, then you become a participant in a negative backlash that will surely come your way. We see people who are oftentimes speaking words out of anger or out of hate. And those very words seem to be a self-fulfilling prophecy. People who are chronically angry, people who chronically speak an untruth, they pay the price. I remember when I was a young boy, and I made several errors in a row that made things very uncomfortable for me. First of all, I stole some dirty pictures from somebody that I knew. So the first act was to steal something. Then I hid them in my drawer and I forgot all about them. One day when my mother was tearing through my drawers and saying, "We've got to organize all this," she uncovered the pictures. Now I was really embarrassed. And now came the questions from my father, "Where did I get the pictures?" Well, I didn't want to squeal on the person I took them from, so I said, "I don't know, they just must have appeared there in the drawer," making up a very lame kind of a lie, but I stuck with it. And for an hour, he drilled me, and I wouldn't budge from it. So that was a kind of a tough moment, and the pictures disappeared and were never to be seen again. And so these things come back on us. That's, a fairly common thing. But when I grew up, I always found it more convenient to say a half-truth or to omit something or to tell a lie rather than to get into trouble and to face the consequences for something that I had done. It was, in all likelihood, a samskara, something that I came into this life with, because it came easily, it came naturally to me. And I had to break my habit of that. None of us like to have to face the consequences of something that we've done when it turns out badly or we've done something wrong. We want to avoid it naturally because we don't want to face the pain. But I tell you, when you tell an untruth and you keep going with it, it creates a kind of prison for you. You cannot get out of it, because now you have to maintain that untruth. People who lie on their taxes, people who don't follow through with things that they commit themselves to, everything goes into the registry of the subconscious mind. And that is why telling the truth first and foremost to ourselves. If we have fallen short of the goal, then we should be willing to admit it. And that's the only way that it can be rectified. Otherwise, it's something that just continues and, as I say, makes a great prison for yourself. Continuing with Master, many a heart has been broken and many a life wrecked by truths spoken by others inopportunely. A sage carefully watches his speech, lest he wound those who are not yet ready to hear and profit by his veracious observations. The Vedas mention three kinds of truth. All values pertaining to man and nature are relative truths. All values pertaining to man and nature are relative truths. These influence human beings during the waking state, which is essentially changeful, ever in flux. All values pertaining to man's ordinary dreams and sleep, such as when he is in touch with his subconscious mind that conjures images in the forms of astral phenomena, are imaginary truths. They have a certain validity, but only in their own restricted realm, which is far more fleeting, vague, and ambiguous than is the world of matter that man perceives in his waking state. So it's very interesting when we go to sleep and we remember our dreams. These days, my sleeping state and my waking state, I cannot discern a real difference between the two. They seem to seamlessly flow one into the other. But in your sleep state, you will have what we call nightmares, and then there are other dreams that are just a very ordinary kind of nature. But they oftentimes reveal things that are residing deep within our subconscious mind. Now, some people think of this as some greater truth than the truth that we know when we're in a waking state. It can reveal deep-seated, buried kinds of unconscious thoughts or feelings or fears that are coming through in the dream state. But it's not necessarily any closer to the truth, to truth supreme. It may reveal something about ourselves that we are unwilling to admit in a conscious waking state, but it's relative to its own dream state. It's relative to the context from which it has come. And so when these things come, we can, when we remember them in a conscious state, work with them, evaluate what the dream was about, and what was it that was bothersome if it was a distressing kind of a dream. You can go back and recreate that dream. It's a very powerful thing to be able to do. You have a dream, say, where you are in a real pickle. You are surrounded by bullies and you don't know what to do and you can't get out of it. And so in order to recreate that dream, you put yourself back exactly in that same context and then you freeze it. You put it on pause. And then you can create all the help that you need. You can call on masters. You can call on God in the form of light or power. You can call upon anything you want because you're creating in the causal or the thought realm. And bringing to yourself all the help that you need, particularly spiritual help, you lift yourself out of the difficulty that you're in. Now, you've just recreated in your own brain new neural connections that connect one neuron to another within your brain memory system. Now you've offered yourself new resources in that deep subconscious state. You've accessed it through the dream. You've given yourself clear instructions of how you want to be able to access those inner resources that you have to give you courage, to give you strength, to give you the ability to speak the truth, whatever is necessary in that moment to turn and face whatever it is you're afraid of. And Sri Yukteswar told the wonderful story of when he was a little boy, and he did something naughty, and his mother said, "If you don't stop this, there's a ghost in your closet, and it'll come out and get you in the night if you are a naughty boy." Well, Sri Yukteswar was quite precocious, it seems, and he ran right to the closet and threw open the door in order to see the ghost that was in there, and was very disappointed not to find one. And his moral to the story was, when you face your fears, they disappear. And this is so true. It doesn't mean that everything that is frightening to us will disappear from the world, but our fear will disappear. Because once we face things squarely, take full account of it, and then draw up all the natural spiritual strength that is within us, we can face that and even overcome it. God has given us the tools to do everything necessary in order to overcome the difficulties that we have in life. This is a great truth, and it is something else that I came into the last life with that seems to be a pattern, and that was a pattern of defeatism. If I came up against an obstacle, I would soon feel frustrated and then discouraged, and I just want to turn away from it and go to something else. And so to begin to really pull upon those resources that you need in order to face this life and make it a victorious life for your soul is very, very important. We're used to contracting and cringing away from difficulties when they come. But if you can imagine for yourself creating a new habit, and that habit is that when you face something that's extremely difficult, you take a deep breath, first of all, and then you take a good, clear look at what it is that you're facing. And most importantly, deep within you, particularly from behind you, you feel a great influx of life force, of intelligence, of grace, of everything that you need in order to stand straight and tall and face whatever it is you're having to take a look at. And then you make a partner out of God. You ask God, how is it that we should face this? What should we do next? And then in that calm that's created by feeling that influx of grace coming in from behind you, you take a look at it and you get an inner prompting. Now, in the beginning, you may have a question as to whether it is a true inner prompting, and you can ask God, is this what we should be doing? And so as you face it, you ask the question, and then you take a step forward, and you just keep tuning in to God. All right, are we on the right track? We, many of us, face this life alone, and that is the great difficulty. We have isolated ourselves from the greatest power, intelligence, and resource that a human being has access to. We've robbed ourselves of the very thing that will make our life victorious, that will make it based upon the rock of truth. Now, Peter, in the New Testament, means truth. And he is the rock upon which Jesus said that he would build his church. Now, Jesus represents the Christos, the Christ consciousness, the universal divine intelligence that pervades all this universe. And Peter had a revelation of truth. He knew that Jesus had come as the Messiah, as the Christ, as is said in the Greek. And because of the way that Peter said it, Jesus knew that it wasn't speculation, it wasn't coming just from his mind. It was a revelation that Peter had had. He knew it. And it is upon that revelation that the new church, the church built upon Christ consciousness, is constructed within us. We begin to construct that church by, first of all, adhering to the ordinary kind of truth, that of man versus man, that which is in the world. And then that begins to penetrate deep into the subconscious mind until it begins to pervade our dreams. It's a wonderful thing when in your dreams, the chanting of Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram or Hong Sa begins to come back through your dreams. You know that it's now penetrating into your subconscious mind. And it's a wonderful thing, and it's a wonderful sign that things are changing. back to Master's commentary, they have a certain validity, these subconscious truths coming through dreams, but only in their own restricted realm, which is far more fleeting, vague, and ambiguous than is the world of matter that man perceives in the waking state. During deep, dreamless sleep, in the samadhi meditation of the yogi, man abides in his true nature, the soul, and cognizes absolute truth. Now, absolute truth is of such a different nature than these relative truths that there's really no comparison. Now, John the Baptist initially came symbolically as the place in the solar plexus here, just where the rib cage separates up at the sternum. And it's interesting because there's no muscular mass that surrounds or is in front of that solar plexus. If you were to get punched there, it really knocks the wind out of you. And the reason is it has no muscles to protect it. It's a very sensitive nerve plexus, and as is everything within the physical body, it has a counterpart within the astral body. And in the astral body, this solar plexus is called the second sun or the moon. It's referred to symbolically in this way. And it's the place of intuition. When you meet somebody and you have a good feeling or a bad feeling, you oftentimes get it right there in the solar plexus. You walk into a room and it has a very pure feeling or, excuse me, a very impure feeling. And again, this comes in. Policemen will say they get a gut level instinct about something. They feel it there, but that's actually a little higher. It's up in their solar plexus there. And they're getting a feeling of something is off here, something is wrong, or they feel like they're on the right trail of things. And so this is the development. This is the forerunner to the Christ consciousness, and it's a truth of a sort. But it's a truth concerning the relativities of matter. And so it is not absolute truth in that sense. And John the Baptist said, there will be one who comes after me who's I'm not even qualified to tie his shoes. He's so much higher than I am. Now this comes in through the medulla, this Christ consciousness that John was referring to. And it's through this Christ consciousness that real truth becomes a revelation within your mind. This is really something when it happens. You feel an upliftment of your entire being. It's not just simply an idea that becomes clear to you. Oh, I got an inspiration. That's kind of light bulb moment is something that can come, and it's wonderful when it does. But it's not the same as Christ intelligence. Christ intelligence involves your entire being when you're lifted up into that truth. You feel the bliss of it. You feel it in every cell of your body and your being. You're enraptured with that truth, and your total clarity is beyond any doubt whatsoever. Now, when you first have revelation in this nature, it's very definitely an upliftment of mind and body and soul that you have during that experience. But then you begin to come down from that experience. And as I have said before, you have to be very careful as you make that transition from the superconscious state to a more ordinary state, because you still have the memory of what you have been given. And you will still have an afterglow of that experience. But the totality of that truth will no longer be with you in the same way. And so you'll find that before what seems so absolutely crystal clear and simple now is a little bit more vague as you're working with your memory to try to capture exactly what was said or revealed during that moment of revelation. And so there's a temptation of the mind to begin to fill in the gaps, to begin to speculate, to begin to try to discern with the mind more meaning than what was given to you in the moment. And in order to be really good spiritual scientists, we should avoid this like everything. When we have a revelation of truth, it is a wonderful thing, and we can write it down or we can commit it to memory, in coming back down from that high plane, but always recognizing that the words that we have and how we try to express it will not be able to convey the entirety of the experience that we have. Now, as you continue to purify the body and the mind and the soul, you come into a state where that Christ consciousness is more and more with you. You feel it as a constant flow. The play of God's thoughts are constantly playing through your thoughts. And God becomes an eternal friend. He is always with you. And sometimes it is comments on more mundane, what we consider more mundane things. It's not always great truth in the way that we may be thinking about it, because God plays with us. He's our friend. He interacts with us in the most ordinary of ways from a human standpoint, because to God there is no such thing as something which is of God and something else that is not of God, because all is made up of God stuff. Now, in the relative sense, we will say that there is truth and there is untruth. There is God, things that are imbued and filled with God and the presence of God, and other things that are its opposite. But through God's eyes, it is all His magnificent expression. And there is nothing that is not of Himself. And so, that intelligence can speak to you as an ongoing presence, and you think about how much we miss God, what we seek through human relationships to fill that void, to fill the things that we are missing through our God consciousness. Some people try to do it by becoming very, very social and always being surrounded with people and friends. Other people try to get truth through intellectualism. And so they read everything, they study everything, they admire the intellect a great deal. And through this, they try to derive the great truths of this world. Now, this will reveal relative truth, but it will not reveal absolute truth. In fact, the mind at that point becomes an impediment to what revelation would come through us, because if we filled our brain completely with thoughts and facts and figures concerning this world, and we've not done the work to attune the mind to that still, small voice operating within us, then we will not get that higher truth. So there are people who are theologians who study the history and the words and all the rest of it, but they do not go towards real truth. And Master used to call these doctors of delusion, because they didn't get the truth, but they paraded around as if they had the truth. And so people will study the history of an era, the language of an era, all attempting to try to get to that absolute truth, and they will never, ever get it. And then if they get other people involved in that, it's not wrong to study these things. They can be very interesting and reveal great things about our human history. But they will never get you to that absolute truth. And so you see people who are hung up in intellectualism, striving for that superordinate truth that they will never find in that way. Continuing with Master, it is a mistake to think that ordinary persons are never in communion with God or the ultimate truth. Now that one statement, it is a mistake to think that ordinary persons are never in communion with God or ultimate truth. Once Mother wrote a letter down to the organization that Master had formed after Master's passing, and she made reference that God had directed her to do a certain thing, and word got back to her that the then president of the organization snorted and said, "Oh, God told her," in a very dismissive way. And Mother's response is that God shall not be mocked. When Jesus came in his incarnation, He strove to have that realization of truth, and He knew it. Every individual who has that kind of revelation, whether it's just once in a lifetime, or whether it comes occasionally, or whether they gain that Christ consciousness, they know its superior nature. And they know when it's God versus when it's not God, if you're really honest with yourself and really sincere in striving to know God. And so when Jesus came to the temple and he taught, and the Sadducees who ran the temple, the Pharisees who were great teachers of the time, when they did not recognize the truth that Jesus taught, it wasn't out of arrogance or self-conceit that Jesus castigated them for not receiving the truth. It's because in his human self, he felt that revelation so deeply, so profoundly, he knew he was in touch with God. And the fact that these others would deny it and say just the opposite, that it came from the devil, proved to him that their consciousness had betrayed them. They were no longer keepers of the temple. They were no longer keepers of the truth. They were political machines now who were interested in protecting their own turf rather than elucidating what real truth was. And it got revealed through so many ways, their excessive taxation and how they dealt with their power and all the rest of it. That was their test and they were failing. When that truth is revealed within you, you get a flavor of it. You get a sense of it. It's like touching a fabric and knowing the quality of that fabric. If you go in and to a store and you touch some cheap polyester and it doesn't feel nice to you, and then you go over to some fine silk or cotton and you touch it, you immediately recognize the difference in quality between those. When you have truth revealed to you, you know the quality of what is being given to you. And then through repeated exposure to that, you can identify it when you hear it in others or when you read it in a book. And you feel the profound truth of it. You know it because it matches that same touch of the fabric that you had with your own revelation of truth. And this is what makes truth universal. Because each and every one, no matter what their religion, no matter what their ethnicity, what their background in any way, when they are dedicated to truth, when they have had this superior truth revealed to them, they can recognize it in any religion. That is why Papa and Master could recognize the truth in Jesus' teachings, even though they were not raised as Christians. But when they read the teachings of Jesus, they recognized what a tremendous God-realized soul, in fact, what an avatar, one who was divinity, who had manifested within the flesh, did not go through the ordinary evolution of a human being in that lifetime. They came full and complete. They manifested their divinity from the very beginning. And that is what an avatar is. And they recognized in this great Christ, when you go to Ananda Ashram, you will see there in the Bhajan Hall, the main building, as you leave through the door there, there's a picture of Jesus praying before Jerusalem. And it's a beautiful picture. And that's because Papa honored it. And not all Hindus are thrilled when they see this, because there is also sectarianism within India, even as there is here. Although, in general, it's a more universal and broad-minded culture than what we find. But definitely, within the teachings of the Gita and elsewhere, the universality is an absolute must, because this truth is something that can be recognized by all people in all places. Isn't that a wonderful thing? Doesn't that free you from having to adhere to any particular church or any particular culture? Now you can look out through all creation and see where the truth is. You might hear it from a child. You might hear it from a foreign text that you've had no acquaintance with up until then, but you recognize it when you hear it. I was having lunch with a friend the other day. He has a very orthodox Christian friend. And he was saying, she really hates he couldn't quite remember the word, and I said, syncretism. And he said, yes, she hates it. And I said, well, that's because Christianity can be equated to other religions. And he said, yes. I said, that makes it more dangerous in her mind. I said, but I love syncretism, because syncretism is recognizing the truth that comes from many different cultures and many different religions. And so when you are established in that truth, then you can recognize it easily wherever you hear it. So it is a mistake to think that ordinary persons are never in communion with God or the ultimate truth. If all men did not occasionally pass into a state of deep, dreamless sleep, even if only for a period of minutes, they could not live at all. And this is truth. If you people are woken up out of that first 2 hours of deep sleep, it disturbs them completely. It can make them hallucinate and go into a psychotic state if it's kept up long enough. And if it's kept up long enough, that person would not be able to live. The average person has no conscious recollection of his soul experiences, but as part of the universal whole, from time to time he must replenish his being from the source of life, love, and truth. Now in this deep sleep state, we are all unconscious yogis. We all enter into samadhi state of union with God. And if we're denied that, we cannot live because we have to be replenished in this way. Once we have dipped into the sea of tremendous God realization in an unconscious state, then we enter into the sleep state, the REM state, or the rapid eye movement state in which we are dreaming. And that is where we take care of business on the astral and on the physical planes, things that are information that has not been processed or experiences that we've had. But we dive deep. Now, when you are able to consciously access that first 2 hours of sleep, you recognize that it is the same state of tremendous deep peace that you have in samadhi state when you enter into your union or your oneness with God. This is what yoga means. It means union with the divine consciousness. And this is what we are here to learn. But we all have this. Every human being does, every night. By honoring the principle of truth in his thoughts, speech, and actions, a devotee puts himself in tune with creation and with the Creator. And so, if we take this one thing, speaking the truth, and striving to know the truth so that we have it both in a relative sense in how we interact with this world, and also we strive to know the superior, supreme truth that is one with God, then we have really put ourselves onto a good track. And when we feel reticent to speak the truth, whether it is the relative truth that we know, or whether it is the supreme truth that God has given to us, then when we, out of fear or out of greed or some other nature, do not honor that, then we regress in spiritual consciousness. And this is a terrifically difficult thing to put ourselves through. To a greater or lesser extent, all persons who meet such a saint are uplifted by his harmonious vibrations. The true man of God is freed from the painful dualities and contradictions of relativity and is fit at last to enter the final refuge of absolute truth. Now, I heard a saying one time, what is the greatest penalty that an individual pays who is a chronic liar? And the first thought that may come to you is that no one will believe them anymore because they're a chronic liar. But we find that isn't true. They'll always find new people who are willing to believe them, and perhaps people who are always willing to give them the benefit of the doubt or are deluded somehow by the smoothness of their speech. The greatest penalty that a chronic liar pays is that they will never trust anyone else, because they will always think that that person is trying to delude them in some way, because that's what they would be doing if they were on the other side of the conversation. And this promotes isolation. every lie that we tell isolates us from God and from the rest of humanity. And so, in all humility and with all courage, we should seek always to speak the truth. Now, it's a difficult thing to do. There is no doubt about it, because we have to face ourselves and we have to be willing to, with courage, speak out and say what is true. But when we do, we free ourselves. And as we become a chronic truth teller, that puts us in closer communion with ultimate truth. And when you have revelation of that ultimate truth, that truth will set you free. So you are set free in a relative sense, because you no longer have to remember all the lies that you told to keep them all straight. You become simple, plain, childlike. And also, you are set free in a spiritual sense through the revelations. And your words become sweet and healing and powerful. Because when you speak truth to those who are accustomed and searching for that truth, they will recognize the power with which you speak. And it will change their lives, it will change your life. So whatever gains we think we may have by speaking untruths, let us be cured of that illusion. The cost that we pay by telling untruths just keep accumulating, and they gain interest, and suddenly they are a burden that will seem to be crushing us. Truth is supreme. And if we worship it and practice this one sadhana of speaking always the truth, you will be amazed at what will occur in your life and how it will truly set you free. Wanted to finish with a small writing from Om Ma, story about Ananda Moy Ma. It's written by our friend Swami Mangalananda. Seeing Ma's complete even-mindedness and indifference to her own comfort, Bolanath, who was her husband, once asked her half-jokingly if she could eat some straight chili powder that he was using in the cooking. Ma calmly took a whole handful of the flaming red powder and calmly put it into her mouth and swallowed it. Her smiling countenance remained unmoved as Bolanath watched in amazement. Later, however, he himself fell ill with acute dysentery and stomach pains. As Ma lovingly nursed him to recovery, she very solemnly told him, "I told you never to test me like this. The lesson was learned." So let us make our words sweet. Let us make them healing. Let the truth ring out. You know, sometimes it seems like others are getting ahead when they lie, they cheat, they steal. I had a boss one time who assured me that nobody could be successful in business and tell the truth. This from a chronic liar. Eventually, even though he seemed to have a tremendously successful business at the time, he went through divorce because his wife could no longer stand the lies. He lost his business, and then he was working as a sales clerk within a store when I saw him last. And everything that he had was built upon a house of cards. But when you build your life on truth, you build, as Peter is the solid rock, you build upon solid foundation. Now, we've seen in many examples in the financial field recently where there are many empires built upon a house of cards, a house of lies, and that those who were doing it looked like they were flying high for a long time and getting away with an awful lot. But for many of them, the house of cards came tumbling down, and they are crushed by those houses when they did fall. And it hurts not only them, but it hurts all the people who are affected. And you know, in a karmic sense, you have to face all of the pain that you create for other people. And when you think about that, that's quite a thing. It's quite a thing to have to face the pain, particularly for public figures or figures who have more power or more authority or more money than others. And we could admire them, and we could wish perhaps that we are in their shoes, until we realize, particularly if they do not live their lives as they should, that they have to face everything that they do in terms of how it affects other people. And that's quite a burden to carry. It really is. If we can accept our lives, that it's perfect, just as God has created it for us, and that we're doing exactly what God has given us to do, if that's the truth, then we are fulfilling life's purpose as it is given to us. And we cannot live our lives for another, and we cannot exchange our lives for another, because God has given you this life. And when you value this life and find deep, deep meaning within even ordinary things that you do, and you find a profound sense of consciousness that is moving you from moment to moment, that is truth steering your ship. And you will be guided aright, no matter what part God has you playing, whether you're affecting millions or you're affecting a few. It makes no difference. It's only the quality by which you play your part. So let us play our parts well. Live in that truth. Speak truth. Make it healing and beneficial and uplifting. And you will be set free upon the wings of spirit. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, I feel the wonder and the beauty of Thy glorious presence in every part of my being. My heart is bursting with my love for Thee. I kneel in adoration at Thy feet and surrender myself to Thee. I feel the power of Thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind and my intelligence are radiant with Thy healing light. My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss of my communion with Thee. I and my Father are one. Blessed Spirit, I am He. Truth within you.